Welcome to UFO Undercover with your host, Joe Montaldo.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to UFO Undercover. Hope everyone's having a beautiful evening, beautiful morning, beautiful afternoon, wherever you are on our beautiful blue planet. As I say every week, I love doing this show. We go out to every time zone on the world. We cross every time zone. Some of our larger listening audiences are in countries as far away as Australia or New Zealand. Matter of fact, to my friends down there in New Zealand today, I know y'all had that meeting earlier today. I was talking with some friends down there, that contactee meeting. So anybody got any information on it, y'all know how to get in touch with me, icar@cox.net, UPRN at cox.net, paranormalradio@ATNT.net. Yeah, I got another address, what can I say? We can go on and on with literally about 100 of them, but those three are the easiest to get in touch with me. Tonight, I'm going to have on Dr. Richard Sarda. Most of y'all should be very familiar with his work. We're going to be discussing his new book, which I can't wait to read. Richard is one of my favorite guests, Hidden in Plain Sight, Beyond the X-Files. I really can't wait to read this. I know this is going to be a phenomenal book. He always does a good job, and he's one of the more informed researchers in the field these days. And it's, you know how I am. It's rare you'll hear me actually endorse a ufologist. It's one of those things that I'm very selective about and very, very cranky about because, frankly, there's a less than good work across the field in general. So when we have someone like this who's actually really getting out there and plugging it hard and trying to make a difference and really trying to give you good, credible information, it's nice to have him on the show. Richard, welcome to the show, man.
Thank you, Joe. I'm happy to be on.
Well, first off, how have you been? I mean, it's been a couple of weeks since we talked. Well, about 2 months, I think. Everything going good, life doing good. Did you go to Laughlin this year?
Well, no, I haven't been there in two years. I'm rarely invited to speak at conferences, and I've been out to Laughlin, I think, about three times over the years. But I don't mind too much. It's okay.
Yeah, they put people like us in the doghouse, but, you know, I guess because we're hard-headed and don't like to play the game like we're supposed to or something. I'm not exactly...
Well, I have no idea. I'm not going to sling any stones. I wasn't invited, and I didn't go, but you know what? That's okay.
Well, this was Laughlin's last year. I mean, I kind of felt bad I didn't get to go out and see it because it was its final year in Laughlin, Nevada. In case y'all didn't know that, ladies and gentlemen, there will be no more conferences, at least... Not UFO Congress won't be at Laughlin. I can't say there'll never be a Congress, but that one won't be there. It's actually, last I heard, and I don't know if it's going to change, but last I heard it was moving to Phoenix, Arizona, and Open Minds owns it. And we'll see how it goes. I got a lot of friends over at Open Minds, and I talk to them on a regular basis, so we'll see what they're up to and how's it going. Now, Richard, have you had a chance to talk with the new MUFON director?
No, you know, and I never spoke with the old MUFON director either.
I can't blame you for that, but...
Well, I never spoke at any of their conferences. I never had any of my articles appear in the MUFON Journal. And in fact, I've had very little to do with MUFON. They have never approached me, with the exception, I think, of MUFON Orange County. I spoke there one time, and I also... spoke at a MUFON meeting in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Other than that, I've had very little contact with MUFON.
It's interesting. You said about the Orange County, one of their people who recently moved to Boston is taken over as my Massachusetts state director. She's an interesting individual. I spent a couple hours on the phone with her the other day. Now, for the ICAR members, her name's Christina, and she will be starting with us very soon. Technically, she already is, but I'm still waiting on a non-disclosure agreement. But the reason I brought it up is, you know, lately I've been getting a big influx of MUFON people into the ICAR. Which y'all are all welcome, by the way. I want y'all to come in and hang out and check it out and see what's going on and do that. But, you know, the reason I brought this up with Richard is I had just met the new director of MUFON, Clifford Cliff. And I got to say, you know, for the first conversation, it's looking like there may be some fundamental changes in MUFON. From their abduction research all the way up into paranormal areas, which was, I have to say, Richard, was a big shock. So, I think since you got the new book out, I think I'm going to drop him a letter, because he told me to drop him a letter anytime, and ask him at least to put your book in the MUFON Journal.
You know, that'd be great. For those that don't know, the new book is entitled Hidden in Plain Sight, and the subtitle is Beyond the X-Files. Joe, I did mail you a copy some time ago, I would have thought you would have received it by
now. I haven't seen it.
Well, you know, the United States mail is not what it used to be.
No, and I heard them begging for money yesterday, so.
Yes, they're cutting people. They're firing people, I think, another 30,000 people or something. They're going to stop mail delivery on Saturday. They've been cutting mail stations all over the country, closing them down, so. The Postal Service in the United States of America is a shadow of what it used to be.
Well, I mean, because you have FedEx and UPS and all these places delivering your packages now.
Well, and the reason that started happening was because the Postal Service was dropping the ball and wasn't providing timely, excellent service.
No, they weren't. And now, thanks to email, who the hell wants to use snail mail?
Well, they, in a sense, they've dug their own grave by providing poor service for so many years. And they had a monopoly, and they took it for granted, and they're suffering the consequences now.
Yeah, and they are, Tim. They are. Now, when I read this book, what can I expect to see in the get-go? I mean, what are we talking? I like this Beyond the X-Files thing.
Well, what you can expect is that I go much deeper into the Nazi connection.
Oh, I want to definitely read that.
To the underground construction program in this country after World War II, beginning in the immediate post-World War II period and continuing down to the present day. There is a definite connection with the underground excavation and tunneling that went on during the Third Reich in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And I know some of your listeners, or maybe many of them, will be familiar with Jim Marr's work, in which he really compares the United States to, or as much as calls it, a Fourth Reich, because important elements of what went on in Nazi Germany in the 30s and 40s were brought over to the United States after the cessation of armed hostilities with Axis powers in World War II. Under Operation Paperclip, entire boatloads, I mean unknown numbers, probably running into the thousands, but unknown thousands, of so-called ex-Nazi technicians, engineers, and scientists, and perhaps others as well, an espionage line of work, for example, were brought to the United States, sometimes under false names, with false documents, with falsified life histories, and were set up with positions here in American industries and corporations, or in academic world, or in espionage agencies, or in military agencies, or other governmental agencies. And they went to work within their respective areas of expertise. And some of them remained here the rest of their lives. The remaining ones who are still alive are, of course, very old men by this point. And some returned to Germany after having spent a period of years, or even in some cases two or three decades, in this country. But it was quite a large program. What I found out in my research was that Project Paperclip, unbeknownst to me, see, I had always figured Project Paperclip pertained mostly to rocket science scientists and missile specialists, but there was more to Project Paperclip than that. There are aspects of it that, to this day, I strongly suspect are very classified. But I found out in doing archival research in the history archives at NASA headquarters in Washington, D.C., that part of Project Paperclip pertained to underground construction projects. Now, I found two memos, a declassified Project Paperclip memoranda in the NASA Historical Archives that unambiguously requested four German technicians under Project Paperclip for the Army Air Force's a so-called underground plant program. And without defining what the underground plant program was, it requested four so-called technicians. One of whom I recognize, the other three are unknown to me, but the first name on the list is Xaver Dorsch. Now, the interesting thing about Xaver Dorsch is that He was, from about 1943 or so onward, more or less the head of the Tote organization. Now, the Tote organization performed the same function in the Nazi military structure as the Army Corps of Engineers or the Navy Seabees would in our military structure, in that the Tote organization was a civil engineering agency that was, unlike our system, however, not a formal military agency. It wasn't a part of the uniformed military services in the Third Reich. However, it worked very closely in support of the military, whether it was the Kriegsmarine or the Wehrmacht or the SS or whatever. It interfaced very closely with them, but it was a civilian agency that worked for the military. Well, it was founded by Fritz Tote, who was the father of the German Autobahn system. And when war broke out, Hitler asked Fritz Tote, since he was one of the premier engineers and maybe the premier civil engineer in Germany, to head up the Tote organization for the Nazi war machine, which he did until he was killed in a plane crash in 1942 in the middle of the war, at which point Xaver Dorsch began to take over more and more responsibility for the agency's work. And by war's end, Xaver Dorsch was very much in charge. At one time, he was reporting to Albert Speer, but toward the war's end, Adolf Hitler removed him from under the command of Albert Speer and requested Xaver Dorsch to report directly to Hitler. And from that point on, about 18 months before war's end, Dorsch was essentially working directly for Hitler. And one of the things that Hitler tasked him with in the closing stages of the war was to construct giant deep underground industrial manufacturing facilities, which he began to do. I don't know how far along they got with that, because during the closing stages of the war, the British and the Americans were bombing Germany very heavily, and so that greatly impeded all aspects of German industry and the war effort across the board. Nonetheless, this is what Hitler had asked him to do, and I do know that he at least had started it. Of course, then the war ended, and I have these Project Paperclip memos from the American military specifically requesting this man by name to be brought over to work on the Army Air Force's underground plant program, and they don't define what that entailed. Now, I don't know if he ever came over to the United States, but I do know that at war's end he was taken into custody by the American military, and they had him in detention facilities there in Germany, because I have two documents, debriefing documents, that he dictated for the American military while he was in captivity. I strongly suspect that he wrote a great deal more for them, and he must have been debriefed much more extensively, but that's all that's fallen through and is available to me as a private researcher on the open public record.
Yeah. Well, you know how it is, that you get a little teaser every once in a while. A lot of that stuff is stashed away in some box somewhere. Probably hasn't even been put on microfilm yet.
Well, and a lot of it, you see, would be classified. I would suspect that a lot of what he did would have been, even back then in the 40s, so far into the compartmentalized black world that it's not too likely that you'd put your hands on that just by doing archival research. I do believe it's possible he may have been brought over to the United States to work for a while. I can't prove that, but I'm thinking it's quite possible. He did resurface in Germany in about 1952, where he founded a civil engineering company, which to the present day is a well-established firm in Germany. So he did have a career in Germany after the war in engineering, but there was a period of several years after the war where he wasn't very much in circulation. I suspect during that period he may have been working with Americans on their underground facilities.
Oh, yeah, probably technology for a setup. You know, I know we did that with other scientists. They provided skills, and we set them up either here or somewhere else.
Well, and he may have been helped to set up his company in Germany at that time, in the early 50s, for all I know. But I do know he had a public career from 1952 onward. And I know as late as, I believe, 49 or 51, he was still dictating documents for the United States Army. He did one in about 46 or 47, then he did another one in the 49 to 51 time frame, I believe. So during that time, in the immediate post-World War II era, he appears to have been collaborating rather closely with the American military. Now, I can say also, in the Nazi period, in the pre-World War II period, and during the war, there was an engineer named Hermann Kemper who was doing very interesting research and design work for very high-speed underground vacuum tube maglev shuttle trains. Now, he took out patents, and I have them. They're Reich's patents. And in his conception, there would have been an underground, very high-speed maglev tube shuttle train system radiating out beneath Central and Western Europe, radiating out from Berlin. And he had a couple of ideas. In one scheme, the trains would have gone about 1,000 miles per hour. In another scheme, my understanding is they would have gone upwards of 3,000 miles per hour. Now, he was working on this in the 1930s, Joe. He continued his R&D work during World War II. After war's end, the Germans continued this maglev technology, magnetic levitation technology research, and it continues in Germany to this day, also in China and Japan. Now, as you may know, there are rumors in this country that there are high-speed magnetic levitation tube trains underground. Those stories have been around for some years. I've heard them. I haven't ever seen one of these things. However, I can tell you that there are patents for them. In 1949, Robert Goddard, the father of American rocketry, who, by the way, did a lot of his most important work in Roswell, New Mexico, in the 1930s, took out a patent in 1949 for a very high-speed underground tube shuttle train. And one of his schemes was also a maglev train. He does cite the earlier work of Hermann Kemper. And in his scheme, the train would have gone about 14 or 15,000 miles per hour in an underground tube tunnel from which air had been evacuated, so you wouldn't have to worry about air friction. That's almost orbital velocity, but it's underground, Joe. Now, that was his patent in 1949. That's an American patent. And his work was followed up by others. There was an interesting RAND study done for the RAND Corporation by Robert Salter, another American engineer. This study was done in the 70s. And Salter's scheme is pretty similar to Robert Goddard's scheme and also to Hermann Kemper's scheme. Salter also envisioned a train, magnetic levitation train, going through a vacuum tube tunnel buried underground at about 14,000 or 15,000 miles per hour and going coast to coast. I have the diagram of the route that he has set out as one possibility in his RAND Corporation document. I have that in the book, and also the patents and some of the diagrams for Hermann Kemper's work. Now, it's interesting to me that this appeared in a RAND Corporation report, because the RAND Corporation, for many years, has been a prominent think tank that has worked very closely with the American military-industrial complex. This has been true for better than half a century now. And you recall that already back in the 50s, the RAND Corporation had done a very important study on the construction of underground bases and facilities. And of course, as my research has revealed, that study did not remain just a dry R&D study that was parked on a government archive document shelf somewhere. On the contrary, a lot of what the RAND study discussed was actually carried out in the subsequent decades, beginning in the 50s and continuing down to the present day. Therefore, I do attach some credence to these stories that are out there about very high-speed underground maglev trains. In my opinion, I think it's probably been done.
Well, I have no doubt, at least in some parts of our country. I mean, I know we have the trains in Japan and some other places that are you know, predecessors or will be predecessors to these trains later on in our future. But and they're fast. I mean, what's the bullet train in Japan do now? 220 miles an hour or something? I mean,
yes, but the fastest bullet trains are now in China.
Oh, are they? Well, see, I got to keep up. And
Chinese,
they're cruising.
Yeah, and the Chinese also have a high-speed magnetic levitation train, mass transit shuttle train that goes from the airport in Shanghai into downtown, and I think it hits speeds in the 250, 300 mile per hour range. We have nothing like that in this country.
Yeah, nothing for public use, I should
say. No, not for public use.
Yeah.
The public transportation system in this country lags far behind what you will find in other countries, in Europe and in Japan, and increasingly even in China. And the good stuff has been held back from us. You know, we're raised to think we live in a free country. On the contrary, we live in a very rigidly controlled society.
Well, we do. We're in a fairly well-controlled society, and they want you driving. They want you buying them big Concord cars and spending all that money on gasoline. That's part of the scam.
Well, sure it is, to separate you from your money. And while they're doing it, they also cut out billions of dollars in all kinds of fees and taxes along the line. So it's a real cash cow machine for them.
Yeah, it is. It is, and it's irritating. But because really, by now there should be at least one train that runs from, say, New York to Los Angeles, and something in the 300, 400
well,
mile an hour range.
If the Chinese, there's no reason why you shouldn't be able to board a train at Grand Central Station in New York and get off of downtown L.A. the same day, and it shouldn't take any longer than a jetliner. Technologically, that can be done. I've read the patents. I've delved into the engineering literature enough to know that it can be done, but it hasn't been done, not for the public. We are regarded essentially as beasts of burden, as economic production units. And we are, you know, 21st century serfs is what it amounts to.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's just an easier way for them to keep tabs on us. And besides that, I mean, you know, a one train that shoots across at 600-700 miles an hour, you're talking 4 or 5 hours in a train. Maglift doesn't really use much in the way of energy. Once it achieves its speed, it's in a vacuum. It pretty much keeps on rolling. So
that's right.
There's not much in the way of energy it's consuming, so you know, really.
No, you could run the trains at 20-minute intervals.
Yeah, well, you don't need anybody on board running them. Actually, the computers can run them, probably do a better job of it. This is a technology that would benefit us in great ways. Of course, it would cost a lot of jobs. I mean, we wouldn't have all these people running these buses polluting the air all over town. I hate buses, by the way. I got to be honest with you. When I was younger, if it was between taking the bus and walking, I was walking. I just don't like the buses. To me, that's the most least efficient way of transportation this country has. Plus, they're always nasty, dirty buses. What, they don't know how to clean the damn things? But anyway, enough about that. But we should. I mean, we should have some kind of system. I mean, lately I've been hearing like the rail systems in both California and New York are outdated. They're falling apart. They don't even know if they're going to be able to keep up with them. The subway system, the subway rails aren't doing much better. I was actually talking above ground rail, but the subway rails aren't faring much better. And they're awkward, clunkety pieces of junk.
You want to ride good subways, you'll have to go to Paris or somewhere else.
I've seen the subways that run between France and London, or between Paris and London through that canal, that tunnel.
The channel, through the
channel. And compared to ours, those things are state-of-the-art. I mean, they showed one from New York and one from there. And the one from there was pretty advanced. The one from New York looked like something that came out of the 40s.
I got on the train. If you've ever traveled in France, and I have a great deal over the years, I've been to France several times. I lived there for a short period when I was younger, actually. So I've been all over the country, and let me tell you, the French trains are just immeasurably better than our train system, just much, much better. Their whole transportation network is superior to ours. In my view, it's easier to get around the country and more economical. For example, you can get on one of their high-speed trains, which they call the TGVs, and you hop on the train in Paris at lunchtime, and you're there, you know, in like two and a half or three hours, you're down at the Mediterranean, in style.
Yeah, comfortable cruise.
It's a very comfortable ride. There's no clickety-clack, clunkety-clunkety, clunkety-clickety-clackety-clack. It's like riding in an airliner, even more so, even better, because you can get up and walk around. The seats are comfortable. You can stretch your legs. It's better than an airliner. If you had the choice between taking the high-speed train and riding, say, economy class and Southwest Airlines, no, I mean, there's no contest.
No, there's not. Now, Perth just wrote in to us from London and said the reason they have better trains than we do is because they have such a smaller population and way less land and way less track. And
let me tell you why the trains are better than Europe than here. They're wasting trillions of dollars fighting imperial wars. If you don't spend $3, $4, $5, $6 trillion killing people on the other side of the planet, guess what? You have money to repair your sewers and your water. You have money to repair potholes in the street. You have money to repair the trains in your own country or to build proper trains. We're not doing that. Instead, we're bogged down in these never-ending, self-destructive imperial wars on the other side of the planet.
Well, the war thing, whether it's got Nancy, she's not agreeing with you. She said England spends as much per capita on war as the United States does.
Okay. That may be the case.
That's for a different argument, and I don't know if I necessarily agree with that or not.
Well, it's certainly not the case for France or Germany.
It's not. France refused to go last I heard. Now, maybe they got somebody over there.
Yes,
now, but last I heard,
it's certainly not the case for Japan or China either.
Yeah.
And instead of spending trillions of dollars on these types of things and maintaining 700 military bases all over the planet, which sops up yet more trillions, they're actually investing in their own infrastructures. And this is why we have so many social and economic problems, because we're sucking money out of our economy by the trillions. And ultimately, killing people is a dead-end economic spiral. It does not have a positive outcome.
Now, Celine just wrote in on Facebook. She's in France. She's saying maybe if the United States would, because she says France feels comfortable as a nation to spend money on their country because they know in a bind in a war the United States would step in and help them out, which is a true statement. And she's also saying maybe the U.S. should now start asking money from its allies for protection. Isn't that like a mafia thing? I don't think y'all can do that. And this one's conversation, I'm not sure where this is going.
Well, first of all...
It was kind of funny.
First of all, you know, whether the United States really would come to the aid of its so-called allies or not, I don't know. Would it? If it felt that its perceived interests were on the line, yes. But there again, what are the perceived interests of the United States? From what I can see, the Pentagon virtually functions as a mercenary army for the Fortune 500. Now, let me ask you, or let me tell you, some years ago I took a flight. I was riding on a commercial airline, and a retired diver for Her Majesty's Royal Navy was seated next to me, and we had an interesting conversation. He told me, among other things, that the Pentagon essentially functions, and this was years ago, mind you, that the Pentagon essentially functions as a mercenary force for the Fortune 500, but more than that, as a mercenary force for the large petroleum companies. Now, don't you know that's more or less what's going on in the Middle East right now? You have the Fortune 500 basically using the Pentagon as its muscle, as its enforcer, to get what it wants in that region of the world.
Now, the whole thing makes me...
Isn't it interesting how the terrorists, for the most part, seem to come from regions that have a lot of oil?
Oh, yeah. Well, because that's where the money is. I mean, let's be honest, that's where the cash is right now. Now, you know, a decade from now, 2 decades from now, that may change as we start to sop up more and more of the supplies. But, you know, I was talking with a friend about that.
Let me tell you, if they found oil in Jamaica tomorrow in huge amounts, I wouldn't be surprised if it would be very long before we'd start hearing about you know, Rastafarian terrorists or something like that.
But we don't have terrorists in Canada or Russia. Russia has a lot of oil. Canada has a lot of oil.
Well, but the American oil companies are not involved in Russia. And
well,
in the
they were
Canada,
involved in Russia until just recently. Actually, I don't know
not
what's
the way they are
with that. There might we may end up being at war with Russia.
Not the way they are in the Middle East.
Oh no! What happened was is the U.S. companies went in and did all the development for Russia, and Russia kicked them out. Now they're arguing about money. Canada does the same thing the United States does in a way. It develops oil, so I don't think you're going to ever see any problems there.
The Canadian system is basically dominated and controlled by the United States.
Well, yeah, I agree with
fact,
that. Guys
is,
in Canada, don't write to us because y'all know it's true.
Well, but I mean, if you know Canadians well, when they let their hair down, they will often jokingly refer to themselves as the 51st state. And in many practical respects, it is true. The United States is an imperial power, and it militarily dominates Canada.
Well, you've got 27 senators, or 27 congressmen right now from Democrats and Republicans that are going to ask. We probably won't see the official bill till next year, but they're going to ask for something. You know, they want to do the American dollar thing now, right? For the Americas, like the euro did. Now they want to do the America dollar with Canada, the United States, Mexico, basically all the way down to Chile and Argentina. They want to make their own dollar. Well, that's all fine and dandy, but the part of the bill I found interesting is they want to offer Canada and Mexico, Panama and one other country, statehood. They want to make us all one country.
Yeah, well, we'll
officially
see what
one country. Well, Mexico's already kind of saying they like the idea. Canada's going to be another story, but when it comes down to the economic thing, I think they're going to do it. It's feasible for the countries to be one because they'll make more money. I just don't know if Canada's willing to give up that much control because they like to change leaders every 6 months, and we don't.
Joe, I don't see it happening.
I don't see it happening anytime soon.
Yeah.
Unless you know, something else happens.
Yes.
Major attack on Canada, major terrorist attack, something along those lines.
Yes.
You know, it's to Mexico's benefit to join the United States. It's not so much to Canada's benefit to join the United States. It would actually bring Canada backwards a little bit, to be honest with you. As far as like their health programs and things like that goes, it would actually take them back a little bit. So
yeah, well, I couldn't comment about that. Those are all hypothetical situations.
Oh yeah,
and I mean I don't even know if any of that will come to pass. What I can say with regard to my book, Hidden in Plain Sight, is that there definitely are many underground bases, and in the first part of the book, I actually list. Not exhaustively, not comprehensively, but I do list about a couple of dozen of the better known and more major bases all over the country. There are many of them, and there's no question that many more of them remain unknown. However, they're everywhere, literally. You can make them under a sea, under an ocean. You can put them under a swamp, under a mountain, under a desert. They can be under large cities, and in fact, Washington, D.C. is a town, like many large cities, that has multiple levels beneath it. The modern city, whether it's Washington, D.C., London, Moscow, Cairo, Beijing, Paris, New York, etc., have multiple levels beneath them, going down and down and down. At the first, some of the most shallow levels, of course, would be conduits and tunnels for utilities, such as water mains, sewers, conduits for telephone lines and steam tunnels and electrical cables, internet, fiber optic cables, and things like that. And those might go down anywhere from 5 to 10, 15, or 20 feet. Below that, you start getting into areas where you may have even pedestrian walkways in some cities. I believe, speaking of Canada, I think Toronto and Montreal have large underground pedestrian malls and walkways. In the Washington, D.C. area, there's one such place called Crystal City, which is on the south side of the Potomac River in northern Virginia, not too far from the Pentagon, right on one of the metro lines, as a matter of fact. So many cities have that kind of underground mall or pedestrian shopping area with tunnels and stores and dining areas and so forth. I believe Tokyo also has this. And So then you have that, and below that you'll have even deeper tunnels. Many large buildings will have sub-basements, sometimes going way far down, 50, 100 feet or more, with multiple sub-basements and sub-levels. Below that, you may have large sewers and drainage, storm sewers and aqueducts for water. And these would see just be the ordinary tunnels and corridors and so forth that would be constructed under cities to help them run, to help cities do the everyday things that they need to do to function. But there are also more secretive types of passageways, corridors, and tunnels. And Washington, D.C. is an interesting case in point. There was an investigative journalist who worked in the D.C. area for a long time by the name of John Elvin. And he wrote a little booklet entitled Hogs in the Tunnel, which I got a copy of. This came out some years ago. And what he was pointing out is that for a long time, starting all the way back in the early 19th century, if not before, tunnels were built in Washington for all kinds of purposes. And, of course, some of these tunnels come and go from the White House at lower levels underground to other buildings and places in and around Washington, D.C. So the reason he entitled this booklet Hogs in the Tunnel is because when Bill and Hillary Clinton were in the White House, remember they came there from Arkansas. Bill Clinton is the ex-governor of Arkansas, and before he was governor, he was a law professor at the law school at the University of Arkansas. And the school mascot for the University of Arkansas is a Razorback hog. And once the phrase hogs in the tunnel, the Secret Service used to holler this over their walkie-talkies when the Clintons stepped out on the town incognito. They didn't always go through the front gate in an armored limousine. Sometimes they liked to just step out on the town and go places and let their hair down in an unofficial capacity. And they did this by availing themselves of the tunnel system that branches out from the basement and sub-basements of the White House. And so they would come and go underground without knowing. And one of the points that Elvin raises in this book, his booklet, is that is the White House then in fact a so-called a kind of a Potemkin village? Is it just a facade? Is it possible that the president and the first family, at least in the modern era, have not really spent most of the time in the White House but lived somewhere else and just pop up there from time to time for photo opportunities in order to have an extra layer of security? I don't know, but I'm willing to believe that could be possible. Now, what I can say is that one of my friends, early in her career, was taken underground in the White House. She was working at that time in an entry-level position at HUD as a clerical worker. One day, this was during the Lyndon Baines Johnson administration, she was approached by a couple of men wearing business suits at her desk, and they handed her some files and said, we would like you to take these and deliver them to the White House. Well, she was floored, just flabbergasted. She had no idea why she was being asked to do this or what was in the files. Nevertheless, she complied. She left her desk, and went across town to the White House, walked up to the Secret Service shack, and said to the guards, you know, I was sent from HUD to deliver these documents to the White House. And they said, yes, thank you, we've been expecting you. So she gave them the documents and turned on her heel and returned to her entry-level clerical position at HUD with her mind whirling. She didn't know then or now why she had been asked to do that, and no one explained it to her. So sometime later, the same thing happened again. A couple of guys in suits showed up at her desk, handed her some documents, and said, we'd like you to deliver these to the White House. Again, she had no idea why, but she was a young girl in her early 20s, recently graduated from college, and she just complied with the request. She again went to the White House, went to the Secret Service guardhouse there at the gate, and said, "Hi, I'm from HUD. I was just sent over with these documents." They said, "Yes, thanks. We've been expecting you," and ushered her through the gate and up the driveway to the White House, where she was really perplexed at that point. They then took her into the White House and to an elevator in a part of the White House that is not open for the public tours. And they took her in the elevator and went down, 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 down. She remembered going down what she thought were 17 levels. The doors opened, and she was passed off to yet another agent whom she presumed was a Secret Service agent, and was escorted down a corridor that she said disappeared in the distance to the vanishing point. There were other corridors and doors opening off of this corridor. She was escorted into an office where there was yet another man in suit and tie sitting behind a desk. She was instructed to give him the papers, which she did. She was then escorted back out of that office, back down the corridor underground, to the elevator, which was waiting for her, and she was taken back up, 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 up into the White House, then escorted out of the White House, back down the driveway to the Secret Service guardhouse, and told, "Thank you, you're free to return to your job at HUD," which she did. And she never got an explanation for that, never understood what happened.
That makes actually sense. They're not going to tell you anything these days.
No, but why did they even have her do that is the point. I will say, Joe, that she was, her whole life, an abductee. A reptilian abductee, by the way.
That might have been why right there.
Yeah, she may have been known to them from an early age, them being the federal alphabet soup.
Yeah. The watchers, whatever the hell you want to call them. The ones that keep tabs on, or the mill labbers, I don't know what you'd want to call them these days. They keep changing the terms on me as we
That was back in the mid-60s. That would have been about 64, 65.
Oh, yeah, see,
like
that's important, because that's the same. Well, Betty and Barney Hill was in 61, and see, I put Betty and Barney Hill in as a mill lab in the United States, so... Because we've been setting up a timeline. I've been working with Melinda Leslie and Leah Haley and Kat and a few others, actually with several others, Randy Copang, on trying to get a kind of a hardcore timeline on when the, I don't want to call them the military, but we'll just say that the people decided that they were going to start abducting contactees for information. We've really been trying to get it down. We got cases that I think go back as far as 55.
Could be, and I'm not shy about saying the military is involved, because there's so much evidence they are.
It's the military, but I hate to use the word military, because it's not Barack Obama's military. I honestly don't think Barack knows his butthole from an alien. I got to be honest with you. But
Barack Obama doesn't have anything to do with it.
I agree.
But there are factions or units in the American military that are involved in this and have been for decades.
Oh, I think they are. I think it's like the American military, some American businessmen, some American politicians, a few others mixed in there, some science and stuff. I think it's a group of them that I don't know who actually controls it.
Well, it doesn't matter who actually controls it, in a sense, but the American military is involved.
Oh, yeah, because they have carte blanche. I mean, there's no repercussions for anything that they do.
They just sweep it under the rubric of national security. And by the way, you raised an important issue, and that is, what is the power structure on this planet? It appears to me there's an overarching agency or organization that's in the background. In fact, one of the people I've spoken with flat out said in his experience there is a bureaucracy, if you will, but bureaucracy hardly does it justice. It's kind of a shadowy entity that calls itself the organization. The members of it are not publicly known. They lurk back in the shadows. You'd be unlikely to recognize any of these people. They don't appear on the 6 o'clock news. They don't show up in newspapers or magazines. They are anonymous individuals, but they pull a lot of powerful strings behind the scenes.
Oh yeah, I would love to find out which conglomerate of families and businesses and military generals and admirals that all roll up to make this group. But I hear people say, "Oh, it's the Bilderbergs," or It's gone. Well, no,
that's
it's not.
Part of it.
It's, that's, yeah, that is. That's part of it. They,
that's at a lower level.
Along.
This group of whom I'm speaking would use the Bilderbergers or the Trilateral Commission, or the President of the United States or the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, or any senator or the Secretary of State or the Secretary, I won't say Secretary of Defense, I'll call him what he is, the Secretary of War, or the Secretary of the Treasury or the Chairman of the Federal Reserve. These people all do have a certain amount, a lot of power in their own right within the bureaucracies that they control, and they're huge bureaucracies that they control. However, there is another organization or power behind them or above them, and that's what I'm talking about. And that organization, that group, you do not see in the news.
No, you don't, and you're never going to see them in the news.
No, you won't.
If anything you ever have, these are the guys that if they're driving down a highway drunk and the trooper pulls them over, you'll never hear about it. You might not ever even see the trooper again, for that matter.
Well, they're not likely to even do their own driving.
They're probably not. You're probably right. They're probably not. And they probably don't drive. They're probably shuttled around and stuff. But anyway, it's you know, we know there's something else going on. We know there's a deeper and darker something underlying or above, something on the side. I don't know what you want to call
yes,
it.
Yes, and the question is, this group that lurks behind the scenes appears to be international. I don't know how far back it goes. there are a lot of, I mean, you can look into this, maybe back to Vedic times, who knows. I've discussed this with other people, but it does appear that there is some possible link with groups off of the planet, whether those groups off of the planet are human or non-human or both is something that I can't tell you for a fact because I don't know. I'm not in the group that liaises with them. However, I think there is at least some circumstantial evidence to suggest that that could be the case.
Well, it could be. Well, I know there's a couple of groups off-world. We know that they've been doing stuff with contactees for off-world colonies and things like that. So they're probably... Now, if they talk about that, the clone body, or the not the clone body, the, what do you call them? They're not clones. They're actually the husk bodies, not even hosts, they're husk bodies. If what they're saying about that is true, what's happened in the past, people like out of the early MJ projects or stuff like that, some of the other projects running in the 40s and 50s, they may have actually been downloaded into new bodies and taken off world. They still may be running the whole damn thing.
Yes. Well, you have to understand, too, that getting back to Washington, D.C. again, there's certain power centers on this planet. Washington, D.C., of course, is one. The City of London is one. And here I'm speaking of the Square Mile, which has been an important power center in Western Europe since Roman times, for 2,000 years. The Square Mile is the original Square Mile city that was laid down by Julius Caesar. When the Romans invaded Britain over 2,000 years ago and seized control of the island, London, or as they call it, Londinium, was one of their important provincial capitals. Of course, Rome was the major capital, but they had other capitals in Western Europe that were very important to them and from which they projected not only military power but economic power as well. So for more than 2,000 years, London has been an important center for not just military power, but economically and politically as well, going all the way back to the Roman imperial period. Now, that's the Square Mile. And to this day, it is a separate political entity, separate from the greater London metropolitan area, and it's been that way for many centuries. So that the Square Mile, or the so-called City of London, is another power center. Then you'd have the city of Frankfurt in Germany, of course, Paris, places like Shanghai and Hong Kong and Tokyo and Moscow, Cairo, etc. So there are many cities around the planet from which power is projected. Now, this group of which I've been speaking would use presidents and prime ministers and national parliaments and military agencies and so forth as its puppets to carry out its will on the planet Earth. And I would say in that regard that Washington, D.C. would be a lot like these other cities, and it has multiple underground levels. One of the things I discovered through my research is that In the last couple of weeks of the JFK administration, just 2 weeks before he had his brains blown out by high-powered rifles in Dealey Plaza in Dallas on November 22nd, 1963, a series of memos had circulated at a very high level in his administration amongst his close aides discussing the construction of what they called the DUCC, Deep Underground Command Center. Now, the plans called for this to be built at 3,500 feet beneath Washington, D.C., with high-speed elevator access from the White House, the Department of State, and the Pentagon, and then at the 3,500-foot level, and mind you, this is circa 1963, high-speed shuttle connector trains, I would suppose. They didn't really explicitly discuss what kind of conveyance it would be, but high-speed connecting trains of some kind that would take people to the command center. Now, these memos popped up just about 2 weeks before Jack Kennedy was killed, but it didn't stop there. It just continued right over into the Lyndon Johnson administration. In fact, a lot of the same players were taken over into the Lyndon Johnson administration. So I don't know what Kennedy felt about it. I don't know if he turned thumbs down on it and it was perceived as a crucial project within the military-industrial complex and they decided, well, over his dead body, literally.
Literally, yeah.
Or whether this was the kind of project that would be pursued without regard to what the president said. I don't know. You know, at that level, it's not always easy to tell how policy is made and carried out. All I can tell you is I have these very high-level memos from people like Robert McNamara, for example, and others at that level, who was then the Secretary of War. And it was carried over into the Johnson administration. My guess is that something like that was done and probably greatly enlarged during the George Bush administration. I also suspect that the construction of the Washington Metro system, which took the better part of 30 years and started in the 1960s, by the way, in the second half of the 1960s, soon after these memos circulated in late 63 and early 64, they were talking about beginning construction in the time frame of 1966 or so, which would be about the time that the metro system started construction. So I've wondered for some time, and still do, whether construction of the metro system might not have been a really good cover for bringing in tunnel boring machines and deep elevators and you know, loads and loads of concrete and rebar and on, and taking that underground and getting a twofer out of it. At the same time, you were making a close-to-the-surface tunnel system for use by the public. Could you have also have made a much deeper tunnel system for use, compartmentalized use, by the shadow government? I don't see why not, Joe.
Well, no, it's a good point. When I first got involved in this field ages ago, one of the very first people I met was an engineer for the U.S. Navy.
Yes.
And he told me one of the things that they did is any time they had a project that the military or the government was doing that was covert, like building an underground city or an underground base or an underground facility, you know, for a bomb shelter, so on and so forth, it was almost always covered with something else, either a foundation for large buildings or, you know, a tram system or something along those lines, so that no one would really care when they started seeing loads and piles of mud and dirt and rock being taken away.
Yeah.
Now, of course, we know that the machines are much more sophisticated. They can reuse a lot of the material. A lot of it's resorted and used into a form of concrete and put back in, so it doesn't all have to be taken out. Matter of fact, a good majority of the stuff doesn't have to be taken out now. It can be recycled or reused from that place, and they also have much more sophisticated ways of removing debris now. But back in the day, going back at least 30 or 40 years, I have no doubt that that's the way they were doing it. It was an easy way to cover up what they were doing, and it was an easy way between the noise that they were going to be making from blasting, cutting, and so forth.
Yes.
And the debris they got to take out, it's the best way to hide something.
Well, when they were doing all the construction at Dick Cheney's house, during the George Bush administration, which I discuss in some depth in this book, there were hundreds of explosive blasts at the vice presidential mansion there in northwest Washington, D.C.
He building his own bomb shelter for him and his bud. You know what that's about. No, Mr. Cheney, I worship you, so don't even look at me. Oh, hell, the Cheney. Okay, I had to say that. That's a good time. We got to take a break anyway, ladies and gentlemen. I'm sitting here. Okay, I'm losing my mind now. I'm Joe McDowell. I'm sitting and speaking with Richard Sauter. We're going to be back in a few minutes to discuss more of his book. It sounds intriguing so far, ladies and gentlemen. Guys and girls, you've got to check it out. There's actually certain things I've already heard he say that I want to know more, especially like the German connection, because Richard and I have discussed the German connection on a couple of occasions. It's a big fascination for me, and it really helps to lend credence to a lot of things that may be going on in the United States. But on that note, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to go take a quick break. We'll be back in about 10 minutes, so please stay tuned to UFO Undercover. Again, I'm your host, Joe Montalvo. I'm sitting and speaking with Richard Sauter, and we'll be right back.
Welcome to UFO Undercover with your host, Joe Montaldo.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome back to UFO Undercover. Like Natasha says, I am your host, Joe Montaldo. I hope everybody's been enjoying the show so far. I thought that first hour went very quick. Not even sure where it went. I don't know. Y'all have to excuse my English tonight. For some reason, I forgot all about Grant's evening. But, I mean, it did it. The first hour flew by. Our guest tonight is Dr. Richard Sauter. Which is one, like I said earlier, one of my all-time favorite guests to bring on the show. Tonight we've been discussing actually several different things, but what he's here for tonight, we're discussing his new book, Hidden in Plain Sight, Beyond the X-Files. I find this, you know, from what he said so far about this book, I can tell you it's going to be an intriguing book. And as soon as I track it, we've now found out what happened to the copy he sent me, so we got to get it back. As soon as I get it, I'll get Richard back on, and we'll even discuss this even in more in depth. Because he is one of my all-time favorite researchers in the field. Now, Richard, before we go back to the book, I got a question for you. I was thinking about while we were chatting at the break. For you, if you had to pick a spot in the United States, where do you think they would be to build the biggest, most secure underground facility in the United States? Let's say to bring, like, if there was going to be a disaster, to bring, like, their scientists and doctors and the big, you know, big wigs.
There's not just one as the answer. There are many. And this program has been going on for half a century or more. There are numerous ones, and if you were running an operation like that, you wouldn't put all of your eggs in one basket. You would want to have redundancy, multiple redundancy, so there wouldn't be just one best place. And in fact, already starting in the 50s and before, there were scores of facilities built all over the United States. That program has never stopped. It continues to the present day. So there are just many, many underground facilities, and most of them are not publicly known.
Well, no, I agree that they're not. You know, it's funny because I just got a question that came in. And actually, right now, Richard and I were talking about this at the break. It says, does Richard think that there are undersea bases in the Gulf of Mexico which could account for some or much of the UFO sighting activity around the area? What do you think? We were just talking about underground bases, actually, at the break, guys, in the Gulf of Mexico. What do you think, Richard?
Yeah, I do think it's possible. I have heard anecdotal accounts of bases undersea in the Gulf of Mexico, and I do attach some credence to them. In looking at the marine engineering literature, I did notice that the subsea floor beneath the Gulf of Mexico is very conducive to tunneling and to excavation. And I have, in fact, I've been told there are facilities that have been constructed down there. So, yes, I can believe that. And, by the way, for example, Gulf Breeze, Florida, and the waters offshore from Gulf Breeze, Florida, are one place where a lot of UFOs have been seen above the Gulf of Mexico. I could easily believe that there are installations like that off offshore from Florida, for example, certainly from Texas and also from Louisiana. I think there is a lot beneath the seafloor of the Gulf of Mexico, and not only oil wells. That'd be my educated guess. I've been told that. My research delving into the marine engineering literature suggests that possibility to me. I also know that the entirety of the Gulf of Mexico, stretching from Brownsville, Texas, all the way across to the Florida Keys, or at least the upper half of it, is under control of the United States military. It is a military zone, and has been for many years. I also know, and I discuss this in my book, that the legs of offshore oil drilling or petroleum production platforms are huge.
Yeah, they are.
The people who haven't lived down on the Gulf Coast and who haven't seen these things being assembled in fabrication yards and being towed down the canals to the Gulf and out to sea to be put in place so they can start production and begin drilling, don't know how huge these things are. They're mammoth. They're like something out of a science fiction movie. Now, having said that, it's true that many of these production platforms have elevators inside these huge legs. And inside these huge legs, there are instruments and equipment related to the functioning of the platforms. And personnel do take these elevators down inside the elevators down inside the legs to work on the machinery and instruments that are down there. So this is quite common in the offshore petroleum industry, and has been for a long time. And I say in the book that there's nothing to preclude extending the elevator down the leg and actually into the seafloor. In fact, this would permit easy entrance to an undersea manned installation that would actually be constructed down beneath the seafloor in the bedrock, and that would be one way to come and go. And you could actually go out to a petroleum platform on a crew boat or a helicopter or a seaplane, and the offshore petroleum industry routinely uses all three of these modes of transportation to take crews and supplies to and from these offshore production platforms and drilling rigs. So you could transfer personnel out under the guise of being drilling rig workers, and they could then transfer, if they wanted, hypothetically, to an underground or an undersea manned base or installation. And this could all be carried out under the guise of an operation for Mobile Oil, Texaco, Shell, Sunoco, whatever.
You know, I was going back to the Gulf. While you were talking, I was looking at something in the Gulf, and I got to looking at something we were discussing at the break. I didn't realize the Gulf actually can get to 14,383 feet deep.
The deepest portion of the Gulf is truly very deep.
Yeah.
A lot of the Gulf ranges from very shallow off of the Texas coast and the Florida coast to extremely deep in the central portion of the Gulf.
I noticed, you know, from growing up down here, even in South America and Central America, the coastal areas, which are quite large, I don't think most people realize, extend quite a long ways off into the shelf, or are quite shallow in most places, at least as ocean-going waters go.
Well, in the Caribbean, in certain portions of the Caribbean and the Gulf of Mexico, that would be true, but not on the Pacific coast, for example, of Central America or South America. There, you very quickly get into the ocean deeps. Now, off of southern South America, in the Falkland Island region, there are some extensive, coastal shelf shallows, if you will, where the depth would only be several hundreds or maybe 1,000 or 2,000 feet.
Well, you know where we think there's an underground facility off the coast of Florida because of a case we worked a long, long time ago. Actually, it's straight out from Tampa, around Sarasota, straight out from Tampa. There's a little chain of islands down there where a group of Ascena was about, I want to say about a 2-mile long triangle come up from nowhere. What the funny part was is the island, it's an island, right? Jeep showed up on the island. It's a little bitty island, too.
Yeah.
So the only way that could have happened is if there was an underground facility.
I wouldn't rule anything out where the Gulf of Mexico is concerned. I fully expect, and I've been told that there are underground facilities or undersea facilities beneath the seafloor of the Gulf of Mexico. So at this stage in my research, I assume that there are undersea facilities beneath the seafloor in the Gulf of Mexico. The only question I have at this point is how many and who is operating them.
Yeah, and who is operating.
Not that they are there, but who is operating them.
Well, that's a good question. You know, when you start talking about anything, you know, out in the Gulf, it could be anybody's. It doesn't necessarily have to be ours.
No, it could be anybody's. It could be the petroleum companies. It could be any large Fortune 500 company. It could be narcotics cartels. It could be a faction from off the planet. It could be a faction that has operations both on this planet and other planets. It could be the U.S. government. It could be, you know, anyone. It could be an entity that is not governmental. It's really hard to say, but I have been told of facilities there, and I believe the stories I've been told because the documentation I have and what I've seen in the Marine engineering literature and in the military documentation supports that. Now, I also discuss in my book, I devote some pages to talking about a book entitled The Silent War by John Pena Craven. John Pena Craven was, during the height of the Cold War, the Navy's chief scientist for their deep undersea programs, for their so-called deep submergence systems project. Now, the DSSP, under that project, it was an umbrella type of project. They developed a great deal of technology and had programs that had the capability to operate miles beneath the surface of the sea. In the public literature, whether military or corporate literature, they commonly cite the figure of 20,000 feet deep. I believe they've gone a lot deeper than that. I believe they work anywhere in the world seas at any depth. But anyway, the figure you'll see in their literature frequently cited is 20,000 feet. And one of the things that some of the technology that they developed were the so-called DSRVs, the Deep Submergence Rescue Vehicles. I find this interesting because they were deployed in the early 1970s, circa 70 or 71, something like that. And in a time period of 68, 69, in the late 60s, there was a report that came out of Stanford Research Institute in California. And this is a report in which they forthrightly discussed constructing manned installations down in the seafloor in the deep sea environment. And they were talking about these installations potentially serving three purposes, either singly or in concert. The purposes would have been scientific, industrial, and or military. Now, some of the industrial purposes that they cited would have been deep sea mining, for example. Imagine if you were a large corporation and you had your own gold mine beneath the Atlantic Ocean, for example, and no one knew about it but you, and you could mine tons of gold unknown. Clearly, you could make huge profits. Or titanium. Or uranium. Uranium is even more valuable than gold. Now, anyway, researchers associated with Stanford Research Institute came out with this publication entitled Feasibility of Manned In-Bottom Bases. And they published this in the spring of 1968. Now, they were discussing making 30 manned installations down in the seafloor, below the bottom of the sea, beneath the seabed. 30 in 1968, Joe. And they felt like they could do that for, I think, $3 billion or less. Then, so there's vastly more money than that now available in the black budget. And the technology is so much better now than it was 40 years ago that I presume it's been done. Interestingly, just a couple of years after that, they said the only thing holding back the construction of these bases was a means to get personnel down there to the seafloor in the deep sea environment to transfer crews. Now, the Navy then had working so-called DSRVs just 2 years later with the capability to dive to 5,000 feet and latch on to a pressure lock and transfer 24 personnel at a time. So there's your crew transfer module right there.
You know, it's interesting that we're talking about that because when I was young, and we're talking a few decades ago, a friend of mine used to do offshore. He used to do offshore diving. And they actually tried to get us involved in it. I'm like, he used to go down and he would spend 30 days underwater. Well, they would come down in steps, and then they had an underwater, basically it was a giant tank is what it was, and they would sit in there and they'd decompress and breathe helium so that they could get used to the depth. But the reason I'm bringing it up is he just retired recently. I'm not going to mention his name, he's a good friend of mine, but he tells me now that they have bolted facilities to the bottom of the ocean. He said you'd be surprised how advanced they are. He said they have heating, air conditioning. He said the last one he was in, he even had gaming stations and plasma TVs and the whole nine yards. Mm-hmm. He said he was extremely comfortable. He said what he thought was funny about it was any time he told them and his friends, they looked at him like he was a conspiracy nut or he was crazy. He said, oh, no, that can't happen. And he says this is common practice in today. He said it's easy. He said they actually build everything above the ground. They put these concrete things on the ground, and they actually bolt the thing down there, and they even connect them together. And he said this is a common practice for the big oil companies, and not just the oil companies, some of the other companies that are running stuff through across the ocean. I didn't know we were still laying cables under the ocean. I thought with satellite and all, we gave that up. So apparently, that's something I didn't know either.
Well, it's big business. Sure, the world's oceans are crisscrossed by communications cables. They're laying fiber optic now, Joe, because it can carry so much more information.
Well, that's true.
There are a lot of fiber optic cables, not only for internet, but for telephone as well. And it's big business. You're talking multi-billion-dollar business here. There are huge ships that are designed and built just for this task. They're very specialized pieces of equipment. They're enormous. They're very expensive and very technically sophisticated. Now, the interesting thing is that in the Navy's manned base documentation, which came out just a couple of years before that in 1966, called the Rock Site Concept, there were actually plans to put families down in these facilities beneath the seafloor, the idea being that most men like female companionship, and it's hard to send men away for a long-term basis and seal them up alone without female companionship.
It is, because they go boogers.
Yeah. So the idea was, at least in this one document, that families would live down there, which raises the question, do we now have a resident population underground that doesn't come up underground and or undersea, for whom the surface world is literally a science fiction-like other world, who live most or maybe even all of their life cycle undersea?
Well, I know
or
they
underground.
I know they were incorporating women in underwater missions and other missions as far as 25 years back. We know that from the Antarctic mission. That's why they put women originally, and I shouldn't say this, going to get all kind of emails. Originally, they put the first woman down. Not that she wasn't a brilliant scientist, but because just to get the guys to shave and clean and be human again. Because guys are funny, you know, you leave them alone for long periods of time, they revert, man. They'll start growing beards down to their belly buttons, and taking a bath once a month, and, you know, you really can't have that. That's not
well, the inner Sasquatch comes out, Joe.
Yeah, it's true. That's what happens. It comes out, and the rest of the guys don't care because their Sasquatch come out, too. So it does stabilize and help things out. And guys will take better care of themselves when there's a female around. It's just how
yes.
it is.
Yeah.
And I don't want to take anything away from women because all the women that are working there are just as brilliant as any guys, for sure. So I don't want to take anything away from them. But originally, that's how it started out. Now it's just, you know, now there's as many brilliant women out there with science degrees doing stuff and going underground and underwater as any men are. Actually, there might even be more these days. And so, you know, they don't have to worry about it as much. But still,
well, what I want
right, there might be families. Yes. There's no telling what's
what I want to say is that a few years back, I was contacted by an artist that's that was attached to the Navy's research and design team that was working on the manned bases concept back in the 1960s at China Lake Naval Ordnance Test Station in California. And he contacted me and said, you know, I was attached to that project and I did a bunch of illustrations for it. Would you like to see them? And I said, of course. So he sent them to me, and they were so well done and so informative, I said, do you mind if I publicize these in my books and articles? And he said, by all means. So I've reproduced several of them in my book, and just looking at them, you know, they say a picture is worth 1,000 words. In this case, it may be more than 1,000 words, Joe. Because you can pick up a lot of detail just looking at these illustrations. One thing that I did notice from reading John Pena Craven's book is that already back in the 1960s, Dr. Edward Teller had asked John Pena Craven to put nuclear missile silos down undersea at very great depth, like 20,000 feet down, and he wanted to make the nuclear missile silos out of glass. Now, why glass? Well, because at very great depth, glass is compressed by the pressure of the deep sea, such that glass in a deep sea environment becomes structurally stronger than structural steel. I mean, far stronger. So if you're going to build something under sea, you will build it of glass and not of steel.
Well, that would make sense. Actually, from what I've seen...
Well, what I want to say is, I want to follow up on that. So John Pena Craven says that in his book, and then when I was looking at these illustrations that Walter Kirshner gave me, one of them was of an undersea submarine base where there's actually a huge airlock in the side of an undersea mountain or mount for a full-sized American Navy submarine to enter this lock and dock undersea inside of this submerged seamount, and then there would be crew quarters and so forth in there. And then extending from that undersea base was a shaft that went out under the seafloor with silos buried in it connecting to the shaft, and silos buried in the seafloor. And I understand that to be an artist's impression of the undersea nuclear missile bases that Edward Teller wanted John Pena Craven to construct. I'm wondering if that wasn't done, because in the Stanford Research Institute document, which I discussed just a few minutes ago, entitled Feasibility of Manned Undersea Bases, they also discussed one of the possible functions of undersea bases being undersea missile bases, with the missile silos actually embedded in the seafloor. So from three different independent sources from the 1960s, I get this idea of the United States Navy putting nuclear missile bases down at very great depth embedded in the seafloor.
That I don't even doubt, not even a little bit. I mean, if we have oil companies and other companies doing this, I can't see that the Navy wouldn't have been one of the very first ones doing it and sinking them down there. You know, I've seen just recently, I was in Pascagoula, Mississippi.
Yes.
There's a naval shipyard down there. There's actually several shipyards down there. I'm not going to get into all of it, but I was down there, and they were showing these new submersible, these buildings they're building. It's funny because they have to fill these things with water to sink them, and then they mount them. Some of them are actually put in these pockets and covered. Some of them are actually mounted.
Yeah.
But they're not made out of steel.
Mm-hmm.
They're not made out of any. There's some kind of composite material, and if they're cut loose, they'll float right to the surface. If there's no water, and they actually even keep a ballast, like a ballast tank in them to keep them, if they're going to be mounted, they actually keep them in there. They said this stuff could almost withstand a nuclear impact. From what the guy said, if it actually was a nuclear explosion around them, they would actually turn to like this glass-type product. But, of course, where they're at, we're talking 3,000 or 4,000 feet of water. There's nothing going to reach them anyway.
What are they designed for?
They're just habitats. That's all. He didn't say what they were actually being used for. They were just underwater habitats. It was a new way they could build them on town, up on the surface. They can be carried out because they can actually be put in a line like a string, and 50, 60 of them towed out at one time, completely filled up with water. Then they sink all the way to the bottom, and they're real easy to maneuver even when they're full of water. They said two guys can handle these things pretty much by themselves, no cranes and nothing. It's very sophisticated stuff. Then they get them where they want, and they pump out the water. And then they have these, like, these snap things inside them. They bring all their equipment and all, and it just clicks in, locks in, plugs it in, goes. It's very nice the way they show them. And it's, from what I hear, this may even be something that later on is maybe be used on the moon or on Mars. He said in some aspects they feel like they might even be testing this for use off-world. Now, he said that. Now, I assume when he said off-world, he meant somewhere like Mars or... Because this guy don't look like he has any interest in space or anything like that. I think it was just part of the spiel about what he was talking about these buildings. But, you know, they're there for anybody to see. As far as I know, they're still there. You know, they're in Pascagoula, Mississippi.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very advanced technology, but it doesn't seem to be top secret or classified. But they're very strong. They're very lightweight.
Who uses them?
Huh?
Who uses them?
They're actually, he didn't say what company it was, because they designed for a lot of different companies, including the military. Because like I said, you have several military facilities there along with a military base, but you've also got several military weapons companies there as well.
Yes. Well, what it gets down to is that a lot is happening both underground and
undersea
that the public are not being told about and haven't been told about. There's no intention of telling the public about them, and this is why the research that I've done is interesting and important, and it's why it attracts so much attention from people, not only other researchers, but the public at large. What I'm doing in my research, the New York Times should be doing, the Washington Post should be doing, CNN should be doing, Fox News should be doing, NBC should be doing, but they're not, and they haven't. It's interesting, you take a person like me with virtually no resources in my spare time, I have done more to expose these programs than these mainstream media outlets with their billions of dollars of resources and thousands of employees. Isn't that a sad indictment of our system?
CNN is like, I'm going to say this again, CNN is Barack Obama's news media.
Well, and before him, it was George Bush's. And before
Fox was George Bush's. Fox is Republican, CNN is Democrat, and they're both propaganda BS news. I don't, honestly...
Well, I watch CNN, and I can't see that it's Democrat. It just seems like a propaganda fount.
Oh, no, they're so pro-Democrat, it's not even funny. If you really watch and listen to what they say, they're so pro-democratic.
Well, the problem is I don't watch them much. I don't have my stomach for it.
I don't blame you. I try. You want to know who I watch? You want to know? If you want to know what's going on in the United States, watch it. BBC America.
Mm-hmm.
You will actually get real, true news without any of the BS or any of the propaganda. Now, don't watch it for their news because then it's full of propaganda. But if you watch it for ours, it's so funny. You can watch the same story, right? You can watch it on Fox. You can watch it on MSNBC. You can watch it on CNN. All three of them are going to have a different take on it. Usually, if you go watch BBC, they'll be somewhere in the middle, nice, snug, safe, and they're usually the one that's right.
Be that as it may, none of them have covered these issues that we're talking about.
No, they're not. Well, I got to say something now. BBC America, actually BBC, actually carries Sundays with Joe Montaldo. They actually carry my show, which is something they don't have to do. They don't carry this one, mind you. I don't know why. Because the one that I do by myself with no guests is actually quite a bit more hard-hitting than this show is, both in this field and in pop. I mean, it's actually, I would even say in some areas, kind of rude.
Is that a television broadcast, Joe?
No, it's a audio. It's a, they carry it on there. They got a thing where they put up your face and they just run the archive.
Okay.
It's after midnight, by the way, for anybody who ever wants to listen to it. But it's actually on the major network, which surprised me because he wrote to me and he said, quite did well. I said, I'm not going to get a check. He said, well, no. That's like, well, BS, man. But I'm not going to tell him no because, of course, it's bringing listeners to me and the network and everybody else. And it's like a trip to coast to coast. It's always good for business, so to say. You know, it just is. Now, another 2 years, I don't know if it will be, but it is right now. And it was nice of them to write me and pick it. And in all honesty.
Yes, but the point is, they put you on at midnight, Joe.
Oh, yeah. And I only do it once a month, too, Richard. I only do the show once a month. And I do
once a month at midnight, and they don't give you a prime time slot.
Oh, hell no. And they're not going to give me a prime. And wait,
that's the point
while we're on this, it's midnight in USA, which means it's 6 a.m. in England.
Yeah.
You know who's watching that? Let's watch some UFO guy or some crazy American pilot. No, not at 6 o'clock in the morning. You don't want to hear that.
So,
but still, they're doing it. So I'm happy they're doing it. I just wish it was at a better slot. And because they offered. It wasn't something I called, begged, and hustled. And we get picked up a lot. And this show is on like 30 or 31 AM and FM radio stations now. And we are prime time, 7 to 9.
Yes.
But we're not on NBC radio. We're not on ABC radio. We're not on NBC radio.
They're corporate controlled.
Yeah. We're not on any of these radios where, you know, if, like where Rush is, if we were talking right now, there'd be, 10 million people may have possible have a chance.
Well, Joe, getting back to the topic of the research behind my book, I have, since the very beginning of my research, been reading and being told about, have been reading and been told about aliens underground and installations, in some cases with covert elements of the United States military. This is a story I first heard back in the 1980s. It has never gone away. I now assume that there's some of that going on. I do believe that the American military is involved with at least some alien or so-called extraterrestrial factions in great secrecy, in underground and also undersea facilities. There's anecdotal evidence indicating that that is the case, and I've talked with people who've been alleged to have been in these types of situations. So I've arrived at the place where I conclude that if even a small handful of them, if even one or two or three of them are telling the truth, then that is the case, and that's the scenario we're dealing with. I now accept that that's the case.
Yeah, I agree. My Wisconsin state director wrote in, and this is a good question he's asking. He wants to know if you know of any underground bases in the Great Lakes area, maybe under the lakes or near the lakes. That's a big area. That's quite a bit of water up there.
Well, yeah, for years people have been seeing UFOs in the Great Lakes region.
Yeah,
and
about.
Yeah, I can say, for example, offshore from Cleveland, people have seen UFOs coming and going from the lake for a long time there. So I'm presuming that there may very well be bases or installations beneath the lake bed and the Great Lake lake beds in the Great Lakes region. Now, I would point out that a large area of that part of the country is underlain by a deep stratum of salt, rock salt. Rock salt is very easy to mine and to excavate and to tunnel in. So it would be real easy to make a UFO base or a military base or a base for most anyone for almost any period, any purpose. Now, Lake Erie is the lake I'm talking about, but think about Detroit, for example. A lot of people don't know, which is in the Great Lakes region, a lot of people don't know that Detroit has miles of tunnels 1,000 feet beneath it. There's a vast salt mine deep beneath the city of Detroit. It's been down there for the better part of a century. It's a working salt mine, and it's just illustrative of what it's possible to do in that region. I would submit that if it's possible to make a tunnel system 1,000 feet beneath the city of Detroit, that there are many other areas in the region where it would be equally as feasible to make a deeply buried tunnel system. I happen to know about the tunnel system beneath Detroit because it is a working salt mine, and I've researched these kinds of things, and in the course of my research, I ran across that information.
Well, for the listeners, here's an easy one for y'all, because y'all can go see these in Louisiana if you so. We have salt domes big enough to put New York City inside of, guys, just to give you an idea. Big enough to put the city of New York. They used to always tell you you could put two New Orleans in them. And I've been in a couple of them. They're huge, guys. I mean, they're huge. Some of them are, you know, just a mile across, 2 miles across. Some of them, literally, you don't see the other side of the damn thing. And they're just big salt domes with the outside layer of rock around
them. Well, I used to work in one of those salt mines, Joe. I worked for Morton Salt. I was, for a period of time, a salt miner. Most of the time, I worked in the mill. But for a short period, I did work underground. I drove. People haven't been underground, don't understand, number one, that you could be water skiing, for example, in the Gulf of Mexico, and hundreds of feet beneath you, there could be men working.
Yep.
And huge caverns. These caverns in the salt mines can just be gargantuan. There are mammoth machines down there. I drove a dump truck, a 20-ton dump truck that had tires that were like, I think they were 8 or 9 feet in diameter. They were huge. And I would pick up 20 tons of salt at a time and then back up to a borehole, to a berm in the dark, and dump the salt down a shaft 150 feet down further to another level beneath me, where they would then come in with huge front-end loaders, just mammoth, huge, gigantic front-end loaders, and scoop up the salt a ton or two or more at a time and dump it into what's called a skip, which would then take it 800 feet straight up to the surface, 20 tons at a time. And people who haven't seen this machinery in operation, who haven't been underground, don't understand that you can have mammoth underground workings, and you can be driving around through the rice paddies and the swamps and the bayous in Acadiana, out there in Cajun country, with no idea what's under your feet or under your motorboat.
And that's the truth of the matter. Well, because, you know, all these people at first, they think, oh, well, you can't put nothing underground in Louisiana. It's swamp. Well, in the southern part of the state, it is swamp. But even there, it's
doesn't
only
matter.
Swamp for...
It doesn't matter.
Oh, I know. It's only swamp for less than a mile, and then you hit bedrock. So.
Yeah, well, in a lot of areas, not even a mile.
Oh, no,
a lot
of
areas,
some of
in a lot of areas, you
shallow.
Just have to go down a few hundred feet. And you don't get into bedrock, you get into rock salt, because that whole region is underlain by rock salt. And once you get out, actually, undersea into the Gulf of Mexico, the salt domes extend right out offshore for miles and miles and miles. And there are just dozens, if not hundreds, of these salt domes, especially in the western Gulf, that are all over the place, and they are just as easy to excavate in the subsea environment as they are in the underground environment onshore.
It is. It's for them. They usually start onshore somewhere, and they'll get their trucks, and they'll start digging, and they dig.
Well, in fact, you can tunnel out under offshore, and some of the domes that are down in the close to the Gulf Coast actually do extend out under the Gulf, and so the mining companies just extend their tunnels out under the sea.
Yeah. It's an interesting thing to see. And I mean, down here, see, that's what cracks me up, because people listen to us going, well, these two guys are crazy. For me, it's just a fact of life, because we live here, and most everybody lives in southern Louisiana has grown up with this and heard about the salt domes. Because, you know, in the old days, they used to talk about, let's put a military base here. We got this place for the president to say, oh, wait, let's put nuclear waste here. No, let's put hospital waste here. You know, things like that. So, you know, it's always been in our local news, so we've always been aware of.
Well, ostensibly, some of these domes back in the 80s were made part of the Strategic Petroleum Reserve.
Yeah,
and the public story was that they pumped petroleum into them to store petroleum there for emergency purposes. Well, that may be true as far as it goes. There's nothing to prevent the government from announcing that it is pumping petroleum in there and, in fact, doing something else with those domes.
Well, I mean, I'm sure in some of them they are pumping petroleum.
No, I don't have any question that
the
petroleum is in some of them. Yeah. What I'm saying is, though, you could, in any of those cases, tell people that you're pumping petroleum in and act like you're pumping petroleum in, but in fact be doing something very different in there.
And there's no telling. I mean, like I said, I mean, we're talking cities the size of New York to be in these things, so there's no telling what they got down there.
Well, just miles and miles of tunnels. Some of these salt mines have been in operation for decades or even a century or more. And so they're just miles and miles and miles and miles of tunnels. I know in the Canadian Maritime Provinces, there are some old iron mines, for example, up there. In one case, I have read that, I believe this was the old Dosco mine, had something like on the order of 10,000 miles of mined out tunnels and chambers.
And
10,000 miles.
Yeah, I know, and you could have whole countries living in there. Well, whole states, I should.
Well, you'd have the problem of supplying people with food and the creature comforts of life. But it is an illustrative example, and it means that some of these mines can be converted to other uses. You can publicly announce, we're shutting down the mine. The mine is out of production. And then you can quietly go in with a compartmentalized project and do something else.
Yeah,
I presume that's been done in some cases.
Well, I have no doubt that it's been done in some cases. I have no doubt that a lot of this stuff has been done in a lot of cases, to be honest.
In fact, when I was talking to one of my sources about clandestine underground bases, he looked at me and he said, he didn't tell me there are secret underground bases. What he told me is, well, you know, an interesting project for something for someone like you to do in your line of research would be to go state by state and catalog all of the abandoned underground mines. Each and every one of those mines is a possible candidate site for a secret underground base. Now, he didn't tell me that some of them are, but he all but did.
Well, and that would be a damn good idea, too. I mean,
except that it also involves a tremendous amount of work. Just to catalog all of the abandoned mines, there are thousands of them, and then visiting all of them would be more than a lifetime of work.
Oh, yeah.
And even if you did visit them and something looked funny or it looked like it might be a secret underground base, how would you document it? If, in fact, it's clandestine or top secret, you wouldn't find a paper trail on the public record. So, in theory, yeah, that's one way to crack the nut. In practice, it's damned hard research to do.
It is. You know, while we were talking, I was looking on the Internet, and I see they got the, Will, I can't even pronounce this, the Willie Skaka Salt Mine. Started producing salt in the 13th century, and they just closed it in 2007 and turned it into a tourist trap.
Where is that?
It's in Poland, I believe.
Yeah.
Yeah. See, they ain't no telling how big. I'm sure they got it all written in here in Wikipedia what the size of it is and all. But come on, I mean, I didn't even know this thing existed. And see, that's what cracks me up about all of this. Most of the people listening to us tonight, and actually, the people listening to us tonight actually may have a working knowledge of some of this because they listen to shows like this. But the average person on the planet doesn't even have a clue. I don't think most Americans have a clue what goes on underneath their feet.
No, I give an example. I give an example in this book of Piccadilly Circus, which is in London.
Uh-huh.
I'm presuming some of your listeners have visited London and maybe been in Piccadilly Circus.
There.
Pardon me?
So we have a big audience in London.
Yes. Well, of course, I have visited London, and I have been in Piccadilly Circus. I've ridden the tube in London, and by the way, I love the trains in London. I love the underground there. But I got this illustration from the London Transport Museum because it shows so well what I want to communicate to people. And that is, you can carry out a very large or create a very large underground works through a comparatively modest access shaft. And Piccadilly Circus in London, on the top, of course, you have traffic and pedestrians, and it's surrounded by shops and buildings and so forth. But beneath surface, it's a regular anthill. You have multiple tube trains, you have escalators, you have a spiral staircase, you have walkways and corridors and tunnels. You have, at any given day, especially during rush hour or during a busy transit period, you have hundreds, even thousands of people coming and going through this place, almost more underground than above the ground. But you wouldn't see most of this. You'd see very little, if any, of this from the surface. And all of that was excavated through an 18-foot shaft. The underground mezzanine with the shops and the kiosks and the ticket counters and so forth, what to speak of the underground staircases and their grand, and the escalators and then the shafts for the trains that are still deeper. All of this was excavated through this 18-foot shaft, and almost a century ago, or I believe actually maybe it was a century or more ago, because the tube system in London is about the age of that in New York, maybe even older in some parts of it. So think of that the next time you visit London or any large city such as New York, Washington, D.C., etc. Think about, as you gaze about and see the buildings around you, think about all of those underground shafts and tunnels and transit facilities that you can't see from the top. Not only the public ones, but the secret ones that are not for public use, that are used by the shadow government and that are compartmentalized, that are part of the top secret world, for which you pay, by the way. And you pay very heavily.
Well,
but
you know,
you're not permitted to know about it. You're not permitted to use it.
Well, I've watched many, many shows about Europe and how it's built on top of this city, built on top of that city, built on top of the city. It's the underground caverns in France, the underground caverns in Germany. I mean, they just go on and on and on and on. And the ones in Italy, I mean, I just don't think most people understand what is underneath their feet. I just don't. Frankly, I don't think they care. I think they just would rather not know.
I asked one of my sources how many people are underground on any given day. On any given day, and he said, "I don't know," and that was the honest answer. No one knows.
Yeah, I would venture. I'd venture to say in the United States, at least 1 million a day.
It's possible.
And I'm not even talking about underground. I'm just talking about stuff that we know about.
Yes, and then with clandestine projects, because they're compartmentalized, it's even harder to find out who's underground. And if there's a resident breeding population, if you will, underground, then all bets are off. There's virtually no way to know unless you're in the compartmentalized world. And even if you're in there, you wouldn't know what's going on outside your compartment.
Yeah, that's the thing. Even the high-ups only are limited to what they know. I doubt there's more than a handful of people on the whole planet that has the whole story, maybe four, maybe five. The rest of it probably trickle down from that point forward to what you need to know and what you should know and things along.
I no longer assume that I understand what's going on this planet.
Oh well, yeah.
I now understand that I don't know what's going on this planet. I know more than the average person, but having said that, what I don't know vastly exceeds what I do know.
Well, see, that's a problem. There seems to be several things going on. I mean, one minute you're looking at the government's doing this, and we're talking about this other government and this other organization, and then you got all of this going on in old world, new world, and in the middle of it, we now have extraterrestrials involved, which has to change even for people like from the old world, like the old Bilderbergs and the different royal lines that managed to get together and stay together to this point, you know, and help create the United States and the politicians with them. You know, they thought they had it under control, and along comes the extraterrestrial.
Well, I think they've been here all along. And
well, I do too.
And the thing with the extraterrestrials is, some of them are human, and some of them are not. And the human ones look so human that they look a lot like us. There's no way to tell if they are passing us in the street. Or I went to a restaurant this morning and had breakfast. How do I know that the people in the booth across from me are terrestrial humans. I have no way of knowing. Well, I know they're extraterrestrial humans.
Well, they'd be hybrids. If they look just like us, they're probably hybrids. Cause
not necessarily, Joe.
Well, no, we ourselves are a hybrid race, so they would have to be a hybrid to look at us. If you go back to the ancient texts, the Sumerian and the Egyptian texts, we're definitely a hybrid race. And even DNA is starting to suggest that we're some type of hybrid just because of all the junk genes and the... And not just that, they found like 4,000 cells.
Let me finish, Joe.
Okay.
It doesn't mean that we originated on this planet.
I don't think we did originate on this planet. I don't think the original building blocks that put us, that made this...
In other words, I've now arrived at the point where I'm seriously considering that there are numerous planets in this galaxy with a resident human population, of which the Earth is only one. And for some reason, we are under some kind of quarantine and not permitted to know about or have public conscious interaction with the other planets.
Well, because we're children, idiots.
Pardon me?
I said because we're children and then we're idiots.
Well, we are very violent, for one thing.
Well, we are. We're just children. Oh, guys, the last 2 minutes of this archive may have a little bit of LaBoche on it, so y'all just don't worry about that. I think I hit a button by accident. But I know we're getting ready to run out of time here. Actually, I think we have, but we're going to go a few more minutes. Quick again, let's talk about the book. I know you can get it on Richard Dolan's sites, anywhere else. I'll leave it up on my site so they can
Yes, they can get it at Amazon.com if they want. If they order it through KeyholePublishing.com, they get a signed copy.
Hey, see, guys? Keyhole Publishing belongs to Richard and Karen Dolan. Keyhole is actually linked off of the Paranormal Radio Network site, so you can get it there. I'll ask David to leave up a link for Richard's book directly from our site so y'all can get it that way as well.
Yes, I believe you pay the same price just about either way, but from KeyholePublishing.com, I did autograph 300 or 400 books, I think, and so if you want a personally autographed copy, you can buy it there.
Well, guys, that's the way to do it. Yeah, I know Rich is trying, he's working hard to get this established so y'all can help it that way. It's going to be a good book either way it goes. Oh, what are we talking about? Because I know I'm going to start, $30?
No, sir. It's $19.95.
Oh, well, guys, come on, $20. Come on, $20. $20.
You won't find this documentation anywhere else.
Oh.
I have been researching along these lines for the past 18 years now, and I can tell you at this point I know so much more than when I began, and I can tell you this in a nutshell. We have been massively lied to. With malice, the lies have not been benevolent lies. We've been lied to with malice and with forethought. It is all by design. We are intended to be kept in the dark, ignorant, and stupid, and productive slaves. With the product of our labor sucked off and literally thrown down into high-tech holes in the ground.
Well, I have to agree with that because it's something. Guys, and remember, hidden in plain sight beyond the X-Files. We told you where you can get it. It's going to be on the site. You can get it. And, you know, while you're in there, if y'all happen to be new to Richard, he has several books. All of them are good. When it comes to underground bases, there's not even anybody that has...
No, and in fact, there... I don't have a lot of overlap between my books, so if someone wanted to get a really wide perspective, they could, if they want to spend $50, get all of the books and read them, and...
Maybe you should put them in a set.
You wouldn't find that information anywhere else.
Maybe we should talk to Richard Head and put them in a set.
Possibly. I originally wrote these books because I was so deeply curious about this. In essence, I wrote the books that I wanted to read but couldn't find when I went to the library or when I went to Barnes & Noble or J.B. Dalton or any of the other bookstores.
I know two out of the three you got I've read. And I got to say, I love you on working on the ground. And plus, I get to cheat. I get you on the radio and ask you questions anyways, which I know the regular listener audience can do. But guys, look, I tell y'all what, he's on tonight with us. Y'all go out and get the book. I'm going to hunt down the copy sent to me since I know where it went. I was here at my post. I was going to track it down for me. And if not, I'll just go get a copy of it. But then we'll get a copy in a couple months. I'll bring him back on, and we'll get into the copy in a little bit more detail so y'all can get your questions together and be ready for it, because I know it's going to be good. I have no doubt in my mind about that. So this will be two good books that came out this year that I like. I still haven't seen Richard's book yet, which I'm dying to see. I'm going to have to call and gripe at him, get him to send me one, because I really am looking forward to reading that one. Dee told me it was, oh, speaking of Dee, while I'm thinking about that, we're doing a pre-record tomorrow, Thursday afternoon, 7 to 9 Central Time. Dee's going to have Mike Fartson on, one of the witnesses from the Phoenix Lights, a 13th anniversary show. Y'all come on and check it out. Fortson. He's going to be on tomorrow, 7 to 9. So if you catch it, you can hear it live tomorrow. You can get some questions in, things like that. It'll rebroadcast. Is it this coming Saturday, guys, it'll rebroadcast? Or will it be the 13th? Okay, it'll rebroadcast. Okay, on a Saturday. Okay. Yeah. March 13th. It'll rebroadcast on March 13th. So y'all can come back and catch it on then. I'm looking forward to hearing it myself tomorrow, because I've been a follower of the Phoenix Lights. I'm still up in the air in the Phoenix Lights. Someone even asked me. I'm still up. And I just had to plug that while I was thinking about it, because my brain's been not working well today for some reason or another. Do you ever have a day like that, Richard, when your brain just doesn't seem to want to keep track?
Well, I think it has to do with biorhythms.
I don't know what it is today. It's been a hectic, busy day. And a friend of ours, Stephen Bessette, called me twice. I was trying to talk to him, but I was in the middle of 5 million things when he called, so I got to find out what he's up to. I hear it's something good, ladies and gentlemen. I don't know. I can't say on the air, but I hear it's something good. I hear good things coming in the future. That's enough of that. Richard, thank you for being on tonight, man. You always do a fantastic job. I know we even barely touched on the book tonight, and I'm definitely looking forward to having you back and getting more in detail in it. But I don't want to give the story away until some people had some chance to get out there, purchase it, read it, get their feelings about it. Any way I can look forward to seeing you soon, or are you taking it easy right now?
Well, I don't know. I rarely speak at conferences. I couldn't say, Joe, but I would enjoy taking questions the next time I come back. Frequently, people have questions that will elicit information.
Oh, yeah, we'll let them in.
That I have, that I might not think to mention.
I'm sorry, we took 6 questions tonight. That was it. And actually, I can still see I got about 25 more on my screen on the side of me over here. See, that's the thing. We get questions from multiple sources now. It's not like the old days where we just get the callers. We get questions from everywhere. We got the European chat room. We got the Palthar chat room. We've got Facebook and MySpace. And I keep them all open, plus the emails. I keep them all open during the shows. And you can steady. You'll always see questions in each one of them. So it's kind of nice to be able to flip through them and go through them. So that's why I'm not as – and I used to let them use the virtual auditorium for voice, but it's not as important now because we seem to have a larger – group of questions coming in from different areas. It's weird. But I will. Next time you're on, I'll go ahead and open up the lines, and we can let them come on and talk with us. Because to me, I prefer to take questions in an audio form because it's easier for me to listen to them. But, you know, some people like them read. Some people like to hear them. So you got it out. We're going to be looking for it. It's on Richard's site. It's on our site. You can get it on Amazon. Anywhere else pertinent or just wherever you're going to be.
Well, I think those are the main places at this point.
Yeah, we need. Who I wanted to talk to you about? Damn, now I forgot their name. I got a friend show you need to be on. They have a nice big audience, and I'm gonna get in touch with him next day or two to see if I can get him in touch with you. And there's a couple other shows you need to be on. They have nice big audiences. People get out there, you can reach them and hit them and talk to them. Because I don't hear you enough, Richard. I need to hear you more out there in the world. You've got to be in the top 10 researchers in ufology, and I hear less about you. I'm going to say this real quick, and y'all don't take this out of context. I hear Dr. Greer's mouth all the time. Never anything I want to hear coming out of it, but I hear it on a daily basis. Richard, on the other hand, I want to hear what he's got to say. I hear him like once a month. Come on, guys, there's something wrong with this picture. Y'all are in control of this, not us. Call your local radio station, bitch. Call your local conference, bitch. Let's hear the good people, all right, the people with information, not the ones making shit up, for a better way of saying it. I'm sorry. I had to get that off my chest, Richard. All right, guys, we're going to get out of here. Richard, again, I want to tell you thank you for being on, man. You were a fabulous guest. Look forward to talking to you near in the future, and as soon as I get hold of the book, I'll let you know. I'll call you and let you know what I thought about it when I read it. But I can already tell from what I've heard it's going to be an excellent read.
Thank you, Joe.
Thank you. Guys and girls, we're going to get out of here. Believe we have. Oh, I'm not going to tell you who's calling next week. It's a surprise. Until next Wednesday, have some fun. Enjoy your life. Smile, people. It's not going to break your face. I'll see y'all next Wednesday.